I'm Jamie Rickard.
And I'm Tracy Sullivan, and we're the career coaches of Fisher.
So today, we are tackling a challenge that so many students and young professionals face, imposter syndrome.
Yes.
I think adults and professionals can say that they also struggle with this too.
Absolutely.
Whether you're sitting in the classroom, stepping into an internship, or starting your first full-time job, that little voice of self-doubt can make you question if you truly belong. But here's the good news. You do belong, and you're not alone in feeling this way.
Today, we're lucky enough to have an expert and alumni on to talk about this important topic. What happens when lived experience, academic expertise, and a deep commitment to mental health come together? You get Rob Reichel, LMHCD, Clinical Director at the Healing Connection. Rob's journey started in the Rochester City School District, where he grew up navigating the complexities of mental health firsthand. With a BA from Cuca College and a master's in mental health counseling from Fisher, he transformed his passion into a career dedicated to helping others heal. His experience spans higher education, outpatient clinics, residential treatment, and nonprofits, making him a versatile clinician who tailors evidence-based approaches to meet each person where they are. Now, as the clinical director at the Healing Connection, he leads the charge in providing compassionate, specialized care for individuals battling eating disorders and mental health challenges. Rob's work isn't just about therapy. It's about fostering connection, creating safe spaces, and challenging the way we think about mental health. Whether he's in the therapy room, mentoring future clinicians, or driving change in the field, his mission remains the same: to make healing accessible, inclusive, and transformative. Thank you so much for joining us, Rob.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So, Rob, my first question for you is, can you explain what imposter syndrome is and why so many college students and young professionals experience it?
Of course. So imposter syndrome is an interesting one, right? It boils down to, I think naturally when we hear the word syndrome, we think of, again, disorders and things like that. But imposter syndrome is this internal belief that someone, or that I myself am not competent, that I'm not capable as others perceive me to be, right? And it's often accompanied with a lot of that fear of, like, I'm going to be exposed of being a fraud. I think college students and young professionals really experience it more frequently. And I think it's natural, because, you know, you're navigating these new environments, you're facing higher expectations, and then often comparing themselves to their peers, mentors, people who they perceive as more accomplished. And I think, again, for college students, that transition from that structured education to independent work really amplifies these feelings.
And would you say that there are different types of imposter syndrome? And if so, what are they?
Yeah, it's something that I don't think a lot of people talk about. I think we all know that phrase, imposter syndrome, I think has been, you know, tossed around quite frequently. But there are these little subcategories. I think there's five common types that at least come to my mind, and I'll touch on a couple of them. I know there's the perfectionist, which is that person who feels like anything less than perfect is a failure. There's the expert. This is the person who believes that they need to know everything before actually feeling competent. I know there's the natural genius. This is someone who thinks that success should basically come effortlessly and feel like a fraud if they start to struggle at all. I'm thinking of the soloist is another one that comes to mind. And this is someone who is a little bit more hesitant to ask for help because they believe they should already be doing this on their own. So it's really difficult to accept that anyone else might know more or might exacerbate that feeling. And then there's one that I kind of resonate with myself, the superhuman, which, you know, is that person who pushes themselves to work harder than others to prove their worth. And I think those are the five that really come to mind for me.
I identified with a lot of them myself.
Yeah, I was just thinking that myself, actually.
Yeah.
So what are some common signs that a student or young professional might be struggling with imposter syndrome?
I think the first things, and some of these are, again, there's the internal kind of observations and common signs, and then there's some of the external that maybe your friends, your families, you know, professors, teachers might see as well. But I think ones that I would be monitoring myself would be some of that doubting your achievements, despite there being clear evidence of success, right? There's like this really notable, whether it be a measurable study, something in regards to like my exam, my scores, there's so much evidence and I'm still doubting that I'm good enough. So that's a really common one. I'm thinking of attributing the success to luck or like something rather than your skill. I think that's one I often would see with a lot of my clients is, you know, they did phenomenal on this exam, or they secured the placement, their internship they wanted, and they go, yeah, but, you know, statistically I had a good chance. It's like, sure. And right, you really worked hard. You did, you had to put the effort in. So there is a mix and match of skill. I also think of the avoiding new opportunities because of that fear of failure. Fear of failure is a really interesting one that I think I talk quite often with some of my, you know, more young adults is, again, how do we learn to fail forward, right? That failure isn't something to be necessarily scared of. But again, if you're noticing that avoidance of a new opportunity because of that, that's a pretty big sign of that imposter syndrome. And I'm thinking over-preparing or procrastinating on things due to that self-doubt. I think that's another really big one that comes up for a lot of people, where I have to make sure I was up all night. I studied for months and months, and really just overdoing it to a point of almost exhaustion or overwhelm. And then I think the very obvious of feeling like they don't belong, or even, you know, being accepted into a specific program or job. I think those are those really big ones that stand out for me.
Absolutely. And I think that even in adulthood and older professionals still feel that way too.
Absolutely. So you mentioned things like perfectionism and comparison. How can students manage these tendencies so that they don't sort of struggle internally with imposter syndrome?
Yeah. I mean, perfectionism naturally fuels imposter syndrome, right? It creates these really unrealistic standards. One of the things, again, that I'm often, you know, orienting, whether it be my clients or colleagues or supervisees too, is, again, that role of intentions versus expectations. That when we're having these really high expectations lead to a lot of disappointment. So how do I move or exist through my intentionalities? I think leading, it often, again, leads to those feelings of failure and, you know, even with minor mistakes. So, you know, comparison makes it worse because students measure themselves against others. It is almost a highlight reel rather than like their full journey of everything that they've worked towards. So managing it can be things like setting those realistic goals, celebrating the small wins. It's something, again, that I think we struggle with at times of, you know, I'm struggling with anxiety and I still went to, you know, that party. I still went to, you know, that event. Being able to celebrate that I still did that despite feeling uncomfortable there. Practicing self-compassion, really big, giving yourself that grace and that compassion. And then limiting time spent on social media can actually also help reduce those unhealthy comparisons.
I was just going to say that because I think when I talk to students, it's like they're living this all the time and they have been for so many years. I mean, most of us in, you know, later adulthood here, middle age, I would say for me, we didn't grow up with this being a part of our formative years as much as our current generation. And I think when they're seeing the TikTok comparisons or the apartments that people are living in or the jobs that people get and the postings on LinkedIn and all of those things that they can automatically feel like, why am I not as good? And it's hard. I can imagine that's so hard to avoid too.
Yeah, it's really a highlight reel, right? When you think about what is the whole purpose of social media, it's to show my best version of myself, right?
Right.
And what's going to get me the most amount of likes, the most amount of clicks? How do I get more followers? And I think sometimes that gets really not blown out of proportion, but I think it's hard for us to separate that and understand, you know, from a logical standpoint, that's the goal, right? I want you to see my best outfit, my best makeup, my best job. My life is great. And then as soon as that camera's off, it's like, oh man, maybe I do have everyday stressors because I'm human.
Right.
I do think though that people do realize that social media, they know that social media is not real, that people are not living that life per se. Because I know a lot of students say like, oh, I did just post that because I was feeling bad about myself or something like that. But then they can't separate that in their mind either, which is so odd to me, you know, that they it's just such a dichotomy, so to speak.
Right.
Other name it, it's such an interesting, we call it like a, you know, a dissonance, a cognitive dissonance or an incongruence, right?
Right.
And it's hard to rationalize because of the way that our brains tend to exist. At least one of the many, I guess, theories is whether I'm existing through what's called my wise mind. Am I thinking through my logical mind or am I thinking with my emotional mind in those situations? And those can kind of switch back and forth. But more times than not, things like social media, it's going to exist more in our emotional mind. And it's going to be in reaction to what am I feeling in those moments. I get to see that person, you know, out in Bali or in Aruba, and, yes. and the pure volume of all of those things that I'm seeing. It's one thing if I'm, you know, on TikTok and I'm scrolling and every once in a while I see, you know, more people maybe being the real version of self, but that's unlikely. So the pure volume of like everyone's life is great.
Right.
And then in comparison to me thinking, man, I'm not there. That's going to exacerbate all of those feelings.
Yeah, exactly.
I feel that.
No, I'm just, yeah. So how can students navigate self-doubt when participating in classroom discussions, presenting, or even, you know, applying for leadership positions?
I think the first thing that comes to mind for me is reframing fear as excitement. And I know it sounds probably a little odd, but really what comes to it resonates with me. And again, instead of thinking, right, I'm not qualified, being able to reauthor, you know, my narrative, the story I tell myself, to this is an opportunity to grow.
And I love how you said that, because when you said that, I thought fear and excitement, what you feel physically is the same.
Yeah. That stomach butterfly kind of
thing. Yeah.
Right. It follows that same kind of biological connection. If you think about, again, not to get too into the biology, but it runs that same pathway, right? The same thing that tells you, you know, I don't want to, like, you know, look both ways before you cross the street. That worry, that anxiety is the same exact feeling you get, you know, when you have a big exam that you have to study for or an interview coming up. It travels the same neural pathway.
And when you talked about like the reauthoring, it made me think of, I think it was Buddha who said, like, if you can change your mind, you can change your life, so to speak. Yeah. So it's about like changing your story. So if you can reframe that fear into excitement, you're actually changing your energy surrounding it.
I think on a more practical side, right, being able to prepare, but don't over prepare. I think it's something, again, when the anxiety takes hold or whatever that feeling it is, it has you start to prepare for things that, again, might not happen. And then that exhausts yourself. So confidence comes from practice, but don't let perfectionism stop you from taking action is what I would normally name.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that kind of goes into my next question, because with new grads, you're going into your very first professional position, and this sort of these feelings are coming up of, you know, nervousness or I don't measure up. What advice would you have for those starting jobs for the first time? And maybe it's the same advice, but do you have advice for those who are newly going into the workforce?
Oh, yeah. I have a couple ones that come to mind for me on this one. I think, you know, recognizing that learning is part of the job. No one's expecting you to know everything from day one. I could tell you, and you know, if my staff were on this interview, they would name how I constantly am making space for failing forward. It's okay to be able to make those mistakes, and I want you to learn. So no manager, no boss out there is looking for someone to know everything. So giving yourself that compassion and grace that I named earlier.
Yeah. I talked to some recruiters and they say the same thing. Like, they were like, why aren't they asking questions? Or why are, you know, we want them to know, like, it's okay. But I do think that you're right. That barrier sort of exists, and it's important that, you know, they're willing to take that, you know, leap and ask questions and learn.
Yeah. I mean, if anything, I'm more concerned, right, as a supervisor, if you're sitting in my office for supervision or you know, week-to-week check-ins, and I ask, how are things going? And they're like, everything's great. And I'm like, kind of concerned that you're not asking and making mistakes. So definitely, again, recognizing that we want that learning as part of that job. I think seeking mentorship is really important. So having some guidance that can really validate your experience and kind of boost that confidence is really useful as well, whether that be, again, another colleague who's been there a little bit longer, finding someone in your field who you might be able to connect. That power of networking and having a mentor really, really sets you up for normalizing and validating of saying, yeah, I was there too, right? It took me a lot to be able to get to where I am now.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think that kind of definitely falls into my question of how can young professionals advocate for themselves in the workplace when they feel like they don't belong or aren't good enough? Like, how can they have these conversations with their supervisors or even, you know, with a mentor?
I think sometimes it comes to being able to, and this again struggles with the imposter syndrome, but being able to prepare evidence of your contributions. I think being able to really track your work and achievements to back up your value, right? One of the things that, again, I'm always trying to get people to advocate for is knowing the difference between being useful and being valuable. And what you want to do is make sure that you're sharing, here is how I'm bringing value to this space, and being able to, again, dialogue around that. I think speaking up in meetings, right, your ideas actually matter, and taking those small risks actually helps with building confidence. And then like professional development, right, attending some of those workshops or asking for the training to build the skills that you're kind of feeling some more doubt about, I think that's really useful and important for me to hear, right, as a supervisor of, this is something I know I want to get better at. And it's great for me to know that you have that awareness. So naming it and talking about it.
My next question is about sort of that, you mentioned the help, like they don't ask for help, but many career professionals don't ask because they think it'll confirm incompetence. So how can they shift their mindset? So if you're struggling with something, how should they approach the situation so that they feel more comfortable?
I mean, mindset is such a really difficult one. It goes back to a little bit of what I named earlier of how do you reauthor that narrative, that story, those reframes. And I think that's what I'm going to consistently recommend, is that instead of seeing asking for help as a weakness, viewing it as a sign of growth. No one actually succeeds alone, and seeking guidance or any form of support actually shows initiative. It shows a desire to improve. So reframing it as a learning opportunity. Every successful professional, at least that I know, asks questions, not because they're incompetent, but because they want to excel at what they're doing.
You know, you did mention like asking questions, seeking mentorship. And then I want to talk a little bit more about the reauthoring, because my question really is like, how can students and young professionals build confidence in their abilities even when they feel like they don't measure up? Could you maybe provide an example of what reauthoring is?
Yeah, I think a reauthor, again, is being able to pay attention to what is the story that I'm telling myself, right? A lot of us hold, again, those internal beliefs. I don't belong. I'm not good. I'm never going to be able to fill in the blank. So reauthoring is, again, figuring out what is this thought. We call them coping thoughts, and at least in the therapy space, rather than one that is problem saturated, that's just soaked into this idea that I'm not good, bringing in one that makes me at least feel a little bit better. And I think what's important in a reauthor is not overdoing it, right? If I believe intrinsically in some moments that I'm no good, I can't hold the belief as I'm the best thing on earth. Mm-hmm. So trying to find that middle ground of what's going to affirm my situation, what's going to affirm a better belief that's more adaptable. So one of the things that I often try to do is focusing on progress rather than perfection, right? Growth takes time, and in small improvements, those things all add up.
Yeah. And going back to the point that you made about celebrating those smaller wins and keeping track of that, I think the evidence might need to be, you know, we let things kind of percolate in our mind. We don't put the accomplishments on paper, and sometimes seeing it in some physical way can be a good reminder that, no, I have accomplished these things. You know, I maybe getting that reminder can be very helpful.
Yeah, whether it be being able to, again, visually write these things down so that way they're a little bit more concrete, but also, again, externally surrounding yourself with supportive people, right? It's nice to have your mentors, your friends, your colleagues who also can make that difference and say, I see you putting in the extra work today. I saw that you, you know, whatever your specific occupation is, you did something different. How was that for you? To be able to have that really helps solidify, I'm actually better than maybe that anxiety or that fear tells me I am.
Yeah, that's awesome. So our last question is, what's one piece of advice you'd give to students and young professionals who feel like they aren't good enough to succeed?
Not good enough to succeed. I think, again, going back to that, you know, success isn't actually about like never feeling doubt. You know, I've worked really hard to get to where I'm at, and I would be lying if I didn't say that doubt doesn't show up at least once a day for me, if not more. And I think really normalizing and reminding myself that it's about learning to move forward despite that feeling. So no one, again, starts out as an expert. No one starts out as a savant in this way. And everyone you admire once felt uncertain. So I think, you know, keep showing up, keep taking risks and reminding yourself that you actually do belong. Growth is going to happen in the discomfort. Yes. And, you know, you are more capable than you actually think you are.
I love this.
I love that, too. Thank you so much, Rob. We so appreciate your insight and expertise, and especially taking the time to join us today. This wraps up today's podcast. Follow us on Instagram and Facebook and connect with us on LinkedIn. We want to hear from you. Ideas for future topics, questions, feedback, email us at ccap@sjf.edu.
Thanks for listening, everyone. We are the Career Coaches of Fisher, here for your career.